never forget the first moment when I walked in Kyo Cinema. I was hooked from there on.
Hello, welcome to the Scan On Podcast, your podcast of the week in film news, Irish and international. I'm your host, Darren, and joining me are...
Jay.
Roman.
And Danica.
And we'll start with what we normally start with, which is, what have you watched this week, Jay?
I haven't watched a huge amount, so I can pretty much go through everything, I guess, in graphic detail.
As if we could stop you.
Yeah, but as if you could, exactly. Okay, I'll start with Bombshell, the Hedy Lamarr story, which is a documentary on Hedy Lamarr. In terms of, you know, there was the whole thing about, you know, she kind of, the big thing, obviously, other than being a great actress, she also kind of studied kind of scientific kind of patents and stuff, and basically invented a kind of a radar thing that a lot of subsequent discoveries have built on, like Wi-Fi, etc. So it was World War II thing. She never got paid for it because, you know, US government.
Yeah.
But, like, the story, it's interesting enough. Like, the story's great. She's great. The form of the documentary is your standard kind of talking heads, kind of clips and stuff like that. So there's nothing really special in that.
It's very sort of drawing, sort of.
Yeah. But the footage that they have is great, and it's really well deployed. It works. It kind of bumps up the story a lot. So it's kind of well placed and smartly kind of put together in that regard. She's great, and the footage of her is great. There's kind of tapes they found of her interviews and stuff when she was older. She became a bit of a recluse in the kind of Hollywood way. So she did interviews about kind of career and stuff like that. So there's kind of, they kind of play some of those, like, and so she's kind of funny and kind of, you know, a bit bonkers, and it kind of, she kind of shut in for years and stuff. So it's kind of a tragic kind of story in the way these things can be. But it's good. Like, I mean, it's well worth seeing. The story's great. If you don't know the story, it's, I pretty much told you, but if you don't know, she's dead. But it's good. Like, it's well worth watching. And as I said, the form is standard enough, but it's, the story is engaging and well put together. So, you know, you'll kind of enjoy it regardless. Like, I think, so that's definitely worth watching. Then I watched The Tale, which I think you've seen there.
I have also seen. This is available on Sky Atlantic for anybody who's interested in watching it. It is distributed by HBO, so you can watch it at home right now, provided you are a Sky customer.
Yeah, it's Jennifer Fox's kind of autobiographical, I guess, isn't it?
Yes, it's somewhat. an interesting way to put it,
because it's a story of her, essentially a kind of...
fictionalized version of her.
Or a meta, kind of textual, kind of weird version of her childhood.
Yes, it's about a documentary filmmaker who is also called Jennifer Fox, who's played by Laura Dern, who basically finds her life sort of thrown into a bit of confusion when her mother finds letters and stories, the tale of the title, which she wrote when she was a teenager, involving her involvement in a love affair between a married woman who owned a ranch with her husband and a local sort of track coach.
Yeah.
Now, in her mind, in Jennifer's mind, this was a story about a teenage romance, and she was pushing her horizon and stuff like that. But her mother, on reading it, has this different reaction to it, where she believes that she was abused. And basically, Jennifer unfurls the story as it goes. It's a remarkable piece of filmmaking.
It really is. What's fascinating about it, like, the word, it, there's kind of a voiceover-y bit to it, and there's kind of conversational things around it.
But it's not only that, well, this is a literal conversation, and she's talking, Jennifer Fox is talking in these terms. It's a conversation with herself. So you have her having a conversation with the character played by Laura Dern, who is her, but you also, within that, have conversations taking place between Laura Dern
and the younger
and
version
the actor
of her.
Who plays the younger version of herself.
And it's really interesting. What happens is, initially, is like the younger version of her is this kind of teen, kind of, not vampish, but certainly in her head, the older version of what she thinks she was.
She thinks she was about 16, 17.
Yeah, and there's almost a smash cut to where she was like 13, 14. Yeah. Like, and the different actresses playing her, and it's clearly younger. So it gets at that kind of memory thing, but it's really smart about how it films it, how it shoots it, what it shoots, what it talks about, how the characters interact to kind of dig at the truth. It's really, really interesting.
Like, it's about how we tell stories, basically, to narrativize our
own ourselves.
Lives. And basically to ourselves and to others. Like, there's a big argument that she has with her younger self, where her younger self refuses to accept that she was the victim in this narrative. She was the hero. She was the champion in her own world.
And the older person is weak because she's, you know, kind of looking back and...
Because she's looking back and questioning.
And she's older and, you know, her life's gone.
And the film sort of unfurls that. And there's a sense, and Fox has talked about this because it is inspired by her own experiences and about how coming to terms with that sort of stuff. And it should be clear, this is a movie that is incredibly harrowing and brutal in its portrayal of the grooming and abuse of a young
child.
But
it's very calmly shot. And
it's not sensational.
No, it's not. It's done in a way that it actually sneaks upon you a little bit. Like, it kind of just creeps along, and then it's like, oh, this is kind of normal in the way that these things
happen.
But
there's also an inevitability.
Yes, there is,
well,
yeah. There's a hurtling kind of momentum to it.
Without ever seeing...
It's incredibly bad. The two, like, Darren is brilliant, and Nalise, I don't know her first name, the young girl that plays her as a teen for the most part of the film, is incredible too. And it's so well shot. Like, really, really well shot.
Isabel Nalise.
Yeah, she's great. She's really great. Like, well worth getting hold of and seeing. Very good.
Okay. Yeah. It's very worth seeking out. And it is available free. And it's a nice reminder that Netflix hasn't cornered the market on the non-theatrical distribution.
Yes, exactly. Sure.
Yeah.
It's also a much better HBO movie than Fahrenheit 451.
I hear that was a bit messy.
That was interesting.
Okay.
Listen, the last week's podcast for Darren to tell you all about the problems.
I'll tell you a tale.
But this
is much better.
I also rewatched Jurassic Park.
Is this any good?
I don't know if you've... It's a little film. It's an indie film.
Yeah.
Like, I catch a lot of shit for this, right? Because I'm too old for when Jurassic Park came out to have the impact that it has for younger folk that may or may not be sitting around the table with me.
Yeah.
And I'm a little too young to kind of have the Star Wars kind of hit that when that came out. So... I feel like that kind of in the middle.
Yeah, yeah. But E.T. should be your movie.
Yeah.
You look at those people abusing actresses and think, that could be me.
I'm kind of imagining Jay now having his Tyler Durden moment about how being the middle children of blockbuster.
Please don't compare me to Tyler Durden. But my time would have been of the Beetlejuice Who Framed Roger Rabbit era.
Which
had much more impactful on
me. Yeah, well, you consider Who Framed Roger Rabbit being one of the greatest movies ever made.
It's probably the best blockbuster it's ever been, I think.
Yeah, and I don't think that's unreasonable, even if I would disagree.
But like, so Jurassic Park is an interesting one in the sense that I haven't watched it probably in about a decade. And the talking about Jurassic World and the fiasco of those films over the last week or so. So I'll watch Jurassic Park again because, you know, let's have a little look with fresh eyes. Kind of, you know, well, as fresh as these eyes get. I watched it and it's fun. Like, Jurassic Park's great. Like, there's great. It takes a little while to get going. The kids are pretty terrible and I want them both to die.
But they're meant to be terrible.
Yeah, I know. But it doesn't mind make me hate them any less, though. You know, but like, things like the T-Rex sequence, it's an all-timer. It's one of the great sequences in kind of modern action blockbuster.
But the fact that a glass of water shaking invokes an entire movie.
Yeah.
But it's great fun, and I can see why people... I can imagine being 10 and going to see that in cinema, or 12, or whatever age you let people into cinemas then. should they even let... That's another question.
On black and white, silent piano accompaniment.
Yeah. So I can imagine the impactful kind of nature of it. To a certain age. Ronan, would you have had that, or were you too young?
Too young.
You were like 2 months old.
I was two when it came.
Jesus Christ.
I think
I'm going to die.
I think I saw it when it came out. I'm trying to think. I would have been
I definitely did, but I was 18 and I was like, for fuck's sake.
You were at the Scorsese movie.
Yeah, I was at the Scorsese tax rate for last year, for Christ's sake. Actually, I watched Tax Stories when I was 12. But anyway, Cape Fear
was probably...
Cape Fear was
Casino. 94 was Age of Innocence, right?
Casino came out in 95. Probably was Age of Innocence.
I'll add some counter-programming for
you. That definitely is. But anyway, Jurassic Park's fine. It's a good film.
You heard it here first, folks.
With the most budging.
No, it is good. I enjoyed it. Watching it, like...
Adequate.
It's not like I'm not the world's biggest Spielberg fan, as people know.
Yeah.
If you've missed this part, I'm not. That, let me tell you, Roland, in all too big detail. So, but you know, it's fine.
How do you feel
about
Player One?
We move on to the next one. The Way Way Back, which I really liked.
Refresh my memory on this one.
This is the coming of age tale with Sam Rockwell.
By the writers of The Descendants.
It's Jarash and...
Nathan, is it Nathan? Sam Rockwell and people whose names...
We're so good on the radio.
Yeah, we're perfect.
But it's basically kind of a young guy goes to... Wherever the hell he goes to.
Is it camp? Is it by
chance? Yeah, no, it's... They go to the shore. It's like Steve Carell is the kind of... is the stepfather. They hang about
Liam James, Tony Collette, Alison Janney, Maya Rudolph, Amanda Peet, Rob.
It's
Corby.
A great cast. But he basically, the young guy, he kind of gets a job, a kind of semi-serious job in a kind of water park where Sam Rockwell kind of dispenses kind of advice to the kind of thing. And Maya Rudolph is his kind of, you know, is she going to be his girlfriend? Is she not going to be his girlfriend thing? And then this thing at home with Tony Collette's mother and Steve Carell's stepdad, who's a bit kind of creepy. And he plays very well, actually, Carell. He has that kind of underlying kind of thing that Jason Bateman has to some degree. You know, that kind
almost
of...
Almost as if... It sounds like you'd be the kind of person who would really respond to Foxcatcher, Jay.
I think Foxcatcher's amazing. How did you know that there?
I don't know. It just sounded out there. Well, anyway.
But yeah, it's kind of, you know, you've seen the kind of coming to HL before, but it's done very well. The point of view is very good. It's kind of that kind of, you know, view from the young guy's thing where he sees everything but doesn't quite understand it all because he's not quite there yet, brain wise. You know, he can't, like, he can see it all happening.
But can't piece it together.
Yeah, he can't quite understand the kind of nuances that and compromises that adulthood brings to you, which is crap. But there, but that's adulthood, man. So it, like, it works well, and at the end it's really good as well. Like it ends quite well and really interesting at an interesting point, which I liked, which kind of they generally don't. They're kind of
they keep going.
Yeah. So
I haven't seen it since it came out, but it kind of for whatever reason it's very joined with Greg Mottola's Adventureland.
I can see that. It's a good first cousin kind of thing to it. Like,
no, I love Adventureland.
I do too, actually. Yeah, quite a really fun.
Really great.
Yeah, I haven't seen that since it came out. I can totally see that as a kind of link. And there's another one as well that came out somewhat around the same time that people talk about when they talk about that.
Okay, you're going to have to give us more than.
I'm kind of stalling for time when I think
about
it.
After premise.
I forget it. 500
Color
Days
scheme.
Of Summer. No, 500
Days, 500 Days of Summer is much older. She's much older.
Which?
500 Days of Summer School. She's much older.
Oh, maybe it's not that film then. No. I have no idea. Anyway, it's some other film. Somebody smarter than me will figure out.
With all the clues.
Good challenge for you for the week there. But finally, I watched The Peacemaker. Which is the DreamWorks first film.
Nicole Kidman and George Clooney.
Yes.
Stopping Nukes.
It's great. Like, I really like it. I liked it when it came out. I like it now. Mimi Leder, action, like, film in action, like, great. Like, this
super sequences. But it's that sort of mid-budget 90s thriller vibe to it that don't really
they
get
They don't
anymore.
Exist anymore.
No, you know, and practical effects, like, in the sense that most of it's done on the street in actual... Yeah. Kind of thing that looks really well. It's that kind of pre 9/11 thriller that the 90s
like
had.
The
that
siege.
Kind of, almost,
the
yeah,
siege.
Yeah, yeah, I do, yeah, yeah. But it is grounded in a kind of real world conflict. There's this genuine kind of post-Yugoslavia breakup, essentially. Yeah. But there's a Russian kind of thing to it. But it's generally around the kind of Serb Croat kind of. Because your man says in this kind of video where he's going, I'm a Croat, I'm a Muslim, I'm a Serb. Kind of thing, you know, and you know, America's done this to us, kind of, and it actually gets at something, or tries to get at something. It's not wholly successful, but it does try to get at something in the real world that actually matters. And the ending, like, works really well. Clooney's great, Kidman's great, like, it's just really well made. Like, some of those films that you'd love to see 4 or 5 of a year, you know, and really enjoying the cinema. So, yeah, I like that.
Ronan.
Good week in the movies. I saw a bunch of things. We already talked about it a couple of weeks back. Dawson City, Frozen Town.
That was on the IFA.
Did you rewatch
it? Yeah, I went to see it again at the IFA because I'm crazy about it.
It's great.
It's beautiful. Really, really great. Brought along a couple of people to see it and they all really liked it too. It's really intoxicating the way that score pulls everything together. I really, really got lost in it.
That score is fantastic.
It really, really is. I've tried to track down the line unsuccessfully so far. It's absolutely beautiful film, and I will probably go see it a third time when it's released. It's the kind of thing I just completely get lost in. It's amazing. I only caught up with one new release, actually. The new, I know, not like me, the new Ozan, Le Monde Double Lover, which is an absolute blast. It's, you know, Ozan going crazy, having his most sort of Brian De Palma-esque fun with this idea of a woman who goes to a psychiatrist for stomach pains that she'd been told are originating from some sort of mental trauma, and it just goes off and has an absolute blast messing around with it. Their ideas of doubling, twins, all these...
Pure De Palma kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Playing, Ozan is really, really good at playing around with the imagery, the way he frames people and the way he plays around with mirrors, reflections.
I remember that In the House. It's quite a lot of that kind of...
In the House is all about the idea of storytelling, which this is too, because there are therapy sessions where it's, you know, presenting your version of yourself. It's really fantastic. It's tremendous fun. And it opens with a shot that I almost screamed at. Oh, my God. I haven't seen anything like that.
We were discussing this last week and I don't have to catch it, but no, I kind of really have to catch
it's I don't think it's by any means
yes indeed
it's not by any means Ozan's best. I think he's done better work. In the House is a better film, I think, and there are some of his kind of older dramas like 5x2 that I think are a lot more emotionally engaging, but it's a blast. It's so much fun, the way he messes around with his general concept, and he just pushes it to places where you're like, will they? Oh, they have, they've done it. Incredibly playful and anchored by some really, really great performances. Highly recommended. Also cut as part of the IFI's Killer Couple series, Compulsion, Richard Fleischer film, based on the same book adapted from the, was it Leopold and Loeb murder story, as Hitchcock's Rope. It's really interesting because I love Rope.
So do I.
Yeah,
it's one of my favourite Hitchcocks.
I think it is my favourite Hitchcock. Was interested to see how the spin on it would go, and it's really well done. It's really beautifully shot. Much more obviously, Rope is this incredibly tense.
Well, it's an experiment, it's a formal experiment with the reels of film and the 10-minute break and the trying to make it presented as a single.
Make it look
cut.
Like it's made out of several 20-minute shots.
To the point where the inspiration of it kind of perhaps gets lost a bit, although obviously that subtext is there. Like, it isn't any Hitchcock film. If you were to pick a Hitchcock theme and you go with sexual frustration, that'll get you there 99% of the time.
I need to fake talk about it. Hitchcock.
Who's the director? Hitchcock. It's about sexual frustration.
I mean, it's in the name, people.
Sorry.
But that's the interesting thing, the way he uses Rope, in that there is a lot of strange sexual tension in Rope, and it's there in this film as well. There's a lot of kind of homoerotic tension going on, and it's very tastefully done considering the time that it plays out really entertainingly, and you know there's some fantastic performances, and the cast plays off each other very well. And then 80 minutes in, I check my watch to be sure, Orson Welles turns up. And you kind of think,
what?
Huh? I mean, you know what's coming, because he's kind of top billing.
He puts the name out there. And
Orson Welles rolls into the film, is all you can say about him. Look, I think he must have makeup on his eyes, because the bags under his eyes are extraordinary. Some luggage. He
when was this?
And 60s.
Okay, 67? Maybe it may not have been makeup.
It may not have been. They look. They're very.
I've never seen
very,
this.
I really recommend it, because at the point where Orson Welles arrived, I got that thing where, you know, a film you're really enjoying, you're like, oh no.
Yeah.
You're going off in that direction.
It's become a Hamlet cigar ad.
And actually, about 10 minutes later, you go, oh, I'm really glad they went this way, because you get extraordinary lengthy scene where Orson Welles gives this sort of one-hander speech. He's playing a version of Clarence Darrow, essentially, and he gives this long speech about capital punishment and morality and all the rest. It's really dense and literary, but beautifully filmed by Fleischer as well, in a way that makes it great to watch. And it's fantastic. It's one of Welles' best hours.
There's like a sense, especially this period of Welles, it's like there's no steering him. You're just gonna let him do what he's gonna do.
There's no control.
Keep the camera rolling.
I think a few years later, he was doing that. Those wine ads.
The Paul Masson classics.
Paul Masson.
Those are the greatest films ever made.
Yeah, definitely. This is what we need to be talking about.
But he apparently had just... he wasn't long off the sort of box office flop of Touch of Evil and hadn't been allowed to direct this film he wanted to, so he showed up on set really cranky. And there is something, you know, there is that tension. Gigantic Wellesian ego in his performance. But he channels it into this sort of furious denunciation of the justice system and the way that people are baying for blood. It's an extraordinary, very, very long scene where he gives this incredible speech. It's really well written. and I sort of felt myself stuck in my seat.
Wells can act though. This is the thing that you forget, like,
he takes it
because he's such a force of nature, and particularly where he went into how much he went into popular culture later on in his career, that you kind of forget that,
and that
there
that
has been performances.
Exactly.
It's like Al Pacino in the hoo-ah.
Except, you know,
Who are the criminals in it's Dean Stockwell, isn't it?
Yeah, I can't
it's early Dean Stockwell, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Dean Stockwell. And both of them, in fairness, fantastic performances. They're really captivating presences.
Yeah.
And they're very, like,
Bradford Dillman?
They've carried out this very gruesome, grim murder.
Yeah.
But they're really, really captivating.
Yeah, it must be.
I'm fascinated by the story. Like, I always have kind of read about Leopold Loeb a few times over the years, and then Rope obviously is the kind of touchstone for it. But you know, maybe there's, you know, a time maybe for a revisit of something,
think,
doing something with it.
Yeah,
are you feeling a compulsion, Jay?
I think compulsion more so than Rope really ties itself up in the.
You would have got away with it too.
Certain class implications of these being fantastically wealthy people, and it plays around with that a lot more than Rope. But Rope isn't interested in that; it doesn't try to. But compulsion really does, in ways that I think have very healthy dividends. Yeah, I really, really enjoyed that. What else did I see? Oh, I caught Eliza Hittman's Beach Rats, which I wanted to see for a long time, and is now on Netflix, and is absolutely terrific.
I liked it. I
liked her first film, It Felt Like Love, but I thought it was kind of a little loose and not especially... It didn't cohere entirely, and I'd heard really great things about this, finally got around to seeing it. Wow, it's such a step up. It's really fantastic. It's incredibly well shot.
Yeah.
It's another one of these films that has an incredibly laconic character who just never really gives as much of himself away. And the film, without oversharing, you know, it carries all the characterization in the visuals.
Yeah.
And the way his interactions... So the story is that he is a... he's a teenage kid in... Is it San Francisco?
No, it's New Jersey, right?
That's New Jersey.
I think so.
Yeah, I think it's New Jersey,
And he is, you know, hanging around with these groups of all real tough guys, and then at night goes on chat rooms and meets guys and starts to meet up with them in the real world, too. And at the same time has got this thing going on with a girl, a sort of fledgling relationship, and it gets deep looking at the tensions of this kind of thing and him trying to figure out his identity. It's fantastic. I really, really loved it. The way that it all comes together in like stomach churning tension towards the end, as I think the film is really effective at conveying the way self repression breeds wider repression. The way that, you know, sort of repressing yourself can manifest in violence in the wider world. It's really good at understanding the origin of that kind of thing.
I thought it touched a little bit on the kind of fluid sexuality as well, like necessarily kind of nailing down any kind of particular obviously kind of that there's a kind of homosexuality kind of thing clearly there, but even then there's
it's
kind of self-loading within
kind
of
like struggling with this thing, having confusion, not really knowing where to go for it, not necessarily identifying as one thing or another, and getting really tied up in, well, what am I, what's going on with me.
What's the name in the lead is terrific. Dickinson, isn't it? God damn it.
It's a fantastic.
He is great. It's a Harris Dickinson. He's
extremely.
He doesn't give much away at all. You've to kind of bring a lot to the table with that performance.
It's kind of that kind of constantly. He's constantly exploring in the film, like even while shutting himself down at the same time. Like, kind of keep it all here, but never stop kind of looking. And it's really well shot in that regard. We have tactile film, really kind of lots of kind of shots of bodies close together and
smoke.
I liked it. I liked it a lot, actually.
And it really understands, I think, with his group of friends as well, ideas of performative masculinity, that kind of thing, of how, you know, these social structures force people to behave in certain
ways. Groups of men, and particularly that kind of thing. Like, you know,
men.
Oh, yeah, we can rub this guy in.
Yeah.
And that kind of men are forced to go along with this, like, because this is
how
rites of passage and
in theory.
Yeah, and it's all.
Because if you're the one who says, well, let's calm down a little less,
then you're the pariah, then, essentially.
Absolutely.
You're really ruining the mood.
These
strange feedback loops, which ties in nicely, I think, to another thing I watched this week, Alex Strangelove, Netflix's answer essentially to Love, Simon, in a way. It's very, very similar kind of pitch. And in, I think one of the most interesting things about this film, which may reflect badly on the film itself, is what it says about the industry. Love, Simon is kind of very desexualized. It's very chaste. I like Love, Simon. I like Love, Simon more than Alex Strangelove. But it is. It's very much, you know, it's very hands-off. Alex Strangelove isn't. It's essentially a teen sex comedy that shoehorns in a gay element. It does it in an interesting way. Again, the idea of performative masculinity comes in. And this character who is he's sort of shamed because he hasn't had sex with his long-term girlfriend, and he starts to realize that maybe because actually he's not that interested in her, he may be interested in men. It kind of envisions an America where, you know, there aren't any issues with sexual identity, but it's the way people grapple with that on a personal level. It doesn't do it terribly well a lot of the time. It's tonally all over the place. It's from, I cannot for the life of me remember his name, Craig something or other, who did The Skeleton Twins, which I loved.
Okay, which would be another
I
example.
Didn't like Skeleton Twins.
You didn't?
I didn't, though, I promise. Yeah. It's not without merit. But
Craig Johnson
had that indie tropes all over the place.
Yeah, kind of, yeah,
it's true. Very
Sundance
film,
which
irks me beyond belief.
Yeah.
Like,
no, I can completely understand.
There's things in it that's interesting. I like Hater and I like
Kristen Wiig.
Yeah, it's actually great, and they're both of them are great. But it just something irks me about the
film. It fits a framework in some ways, I think.
Yeah,
and it's very much that kind of difficult older siblings.
Yeah,
we've seen a lot of times in Sundance movies. I like The Skeleton Twins affair, but I found it very, very funny. Alex Strangelove actually has moments of hilarity, and if you do like teen sex comedies, and I recognize I'm, you know,
you've been aged out.
Yeah, I'm much more than a decade beyond this thing now. So
this
I am
is turning
not the
into a very
audience.
Sad podcast about how old we are.
So,
some of us are too old.
My life is that podcast.
Yeah, some of us are too old for Spielberg. Some of us are too old for teen sex comedies.
The only support group will have to be formed.
It's got some things that I'm sure people of a younger vintage will enjoy. But, you know,
kids,
children
with the hip hop,
there's
and
a
the
lot
rock and roll,
and their iced creams. There's a lot of silly stuff in there that it can be quite funny, but it never quite coheres. And it has the same problem that Love, Simon had at times, I think, and that these protagonists are kind of dicks. They behave horribly to people around them, and that happens sometimes when you've got shit going on with yourself, and that you behave strangely to other people, but they're oddly irredeemable. The protagonists in both of these films,
which is a problem.
Yeah, it really is. I didn't like.
Thought that only one of the central characters in Love, Simon was irredeemable. To be fair,
irredeemable is very, very.
I like that. Even accepting that irredeemable is a strong word. I like that we both agree at least one of them is.
I've put it out way too far. He's not irredeemable, but you know he does things that pretty much completely loses me at various points in the film. Alex Strangelove also, that's a terrible title.
I was going to say, it's either extremely literal or really stupid, or both.
The characters,
is he studying to become a...
It's got nothing whatsoever to do with Strangelove. The character's surname is True Love, and there's a joke about, awkward as a teenager, and then it's just called Alex Strangelove for no reason. What are you doing? Are you piggybacking on something that's completely different?
It's really irritating.
Very
strange. I do love the idea of sort of Kubrick cinephiles just clicking through Netflix and being inevitably...
A prequel!
It's the highest of prequels! Was it? They're doing Doctor Sleep. Isn't that the one they're doing with Kubrick writer?
I quite like that book. That's all I'm going to say about it.
Okay.
I'm interested to see whether they follow
the book or
they make a sequel to Kubrick's Shining.
I really think the idea of making a sequel to Kubrick's Shining is ill-advised.
I hope they're not making a sequel to the 97
miniseries.
Which
Kubrick holds up as the one true example of how to bring The Shining to film. It is not the Hunter example.
What we need is Tim Matheson.
No.
Interesting.
Wasn't it Tim Matheson that was the Jack Torrance in the TV?
No, Stephen Weber.
From
Wings. Oh, sorry.
Yeah. From Wings.
Yeah.
Oh, God, it's even worse.
All right, then. So, Danica, what did you watch this week?
I've had a really quiet week. I've been off kind of exploring and in Spain and France. So,
it's a better
watching
weekend.
Real life.
Yeah.
We've got cinemas there.
So, I got to see two movies, and one I'm sure is on the top 10, so we'll save thoughts for that.
Yeah.
But one, I don't know when it comes out here, but I was super excited to see it, is The Man Who Killed Don Quixote.
Oh!
Ooh!
Fancy pants on.
So this was like a an interesting one, because Gilliam was one of like the first directors that I could point to and go, that's a director, and this is what a director does. Yeah. And, I mean, that run from Brazil up to 12 Monkeys is pretty...
pretty strong.
A really solid run.
It's a really solid run. I mean, Munchausen's in there, and then, you know... Yeah,
but even Munchausen is likeable for its flaws.
Yeah.
Okay, Ronan just shot me a look, listening.
I said it's a lot of wild fun.
Yeah, no, it is. It's fun, but it's yeah. certainly not Brazil or Fisher King, I mean, yeah. is really top-notch stuff. I've been kind of following this movie... for
like the rest of us for a decade.
Yeah, 15 years or so. You know, I had a copy of the Lost in La Mancha DVD, and yeah. I remember watching it and thinking, what could have been? But kind of the last few years haven't been particularly kind to Gilliam as yes. an artist yeah. or as a person. He's kind yeah. of
Gilliam
like,
hasn't been kind to
yeah, no, exactly,
years.
Exactly. I mean... he's been very critical of this Me Too movement as being shrill and stuff, and he wrote this really ugly defense of his good friend Johnny Depp against this horrible actress Amber Heard, and he didn't believe she was such a good actress as this, and never apologized for it, but wrote this huge thing that... like we all know, like Depp has admitted to like no contest to all those claims, but and Amber Heard was tired as this attention seeker
and donated all of the winnings and awards to charity.
Absolutely horrible treatment. So basically, this film comes along. I've been waiting for it for so long, and by the time it comes along, I really don't care anymore.
Yeah.
I really don't care anymore. I mean, it's not just personally, Gilliam. The last two movies have been interesting, but not...
Zero Theorem and what was the last
The Imaginarium of Dr.
Was that the last one before
that? Was it Tideland? Was that?
Tideland predates Parnassus.
Okay, because I remember Tideland being actually quite interesting.
I like Tideland a lot, actually.
Yeah. But Parnassus which you understand why that's a mess. But then, Zero Theorem.
Zero Theorem was not great.
What I loved about... what got me interested in Gilliam as a filmmaker was that everything felt kind of handmade and very, very carefully constructed. Yeah. And then since Imaginarium, or maybe even since Brothers Grimm, the characters so easily just go into these CGI Tim Burton green screen wonderlands that everyone looks the same. There's nothing unique about it. So I'm watching this movie and I want it to be good. I really, really want it to be good. And the only thing I could think, well, I was like, they spent 15 years trying to get this, like, could have given it one more pass on the script, It's an interesting story. It's an interesting way of retelling the Don Quixote mythos, but... it's a mess.
a mess doesn't sound surprising in the kind of late Gilliam territory.
Like. Also, the passion project sort of...
it's always a worry, isn't it? The passion project is always a worry. Like, they almost never go well for any filmmaker.
Yeah. I mean, Adam Driver is doing good work and kind of having fun with it, but there's just too often... within his movies, within this one, that you're like, why is the character doing this? And obviously, you're dealing with kind of fantasy encroaching into the real world. But I think in something like The Fisher King, everything was justifiable. You could see why everything.
Jeff Bridges' character, like a real person who just happened to have encountered Robin Williams, who may or may not be mad.
And it's wonderful. And here, it just doesn't have that cohesiveness to it. When's it coming out here? Do you know?
I don't know. Does it have a release date scheduled?
No idea.
I mean, I strongly
recommend it'd be a while away. I would imagine it's a Cannes film. Probably be next year.
There was legal battles as well.
Which may delay it even further.
Anyway, I encourage people to check it out, but it's...
I'm in no hurry to see it, though I probably will.
Yeah.
Because I've fond memories of renting out Lost in the Mancha in laser video back in the old days.
But it feels almost like a grudging obligation.
I have to see it because it's kind of... I'd similar to the guy, it would have been a cornerstone of something that of the Gilliam filmmaker I really loved back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
I still want to see the film that, even the Gilliam person...
I'm pretty sure actually...
knock off it. kick down a flight of stairs these days, like, you know?
It, within that stretch I was talking about, like...
it doesn't have a UK or Ireland release date.
Oh,
yet,
wow.
Apparently.
It'll be 2019, I would suspect.
Well, it's releasing in Russia in September and Italy in November.
It's out in Spain and France.
And in Australia at the Sydney Film Festival this week.
But within that stretch, we got to mention also the Crimson Permanent Assurance from... Monty Python's Meaning of Life, the short film at the start that he just kept on making. No one told him to stop, and it's beautiful and it's wonderful. But yeah, that's all I've seen this week. Unfortunately, next week
that's a biggie though. That's pretty good.
Yeah, I can sit back on that.
Yeah, give a lot of new updates for next week.
I've also I've seen several films that haven't actually been made yet. Is the only way you can really sort of top that. So in terms of my film going this week, it was fairly light. I rewatched The Prestige and Following. Field Jesus is radiating. I had reasons for doing
that. I know you do. It's the only reason I'm not knocking you off your chair right now.
Okay. The Prestige remains one of the best movies of the 21st century so far. It's okay, Jay.
Are you going to say The Following isn't rubbish?
Following is interesting. It's fascinating.
Rubbish. It's a nice first effort.
It's a fantastic first effort.
Yeah. It's a terrible first effort.
Shot on Saturdays while working in a regular job on a budget of £2,000.
I can take a billion films that at first films are way better than.
Okay, but I'm made sorry. On that budget in London.
Smudget. You can make for a film you can't.
Alright.
What's the Blair Witch Project cost?
I feel like Jay's cinema experience has a new challenge coming at the end of it.
I'm not watching any more Nolan films, so stop.
No, I was more suggesting making a movie for £2,000.
I'll do it. Don't even go there, girlfriend.
You can do it a lot easier.
Don't care about
it.
I would love to see Jay.
Like a Fulcinino, it's like, I...
Heaven's Gate in Dublin City Centre.
So now you keep it yours. Get a horror factory.
But yeah, Following is a fascinating debut. You can see a lot of the tropes that are not yet fully developed, a lot of the same ideas, all the stuff that permeates through into Memento, Insomnia, but also obviously elements like Cobb serving as an obvious pretext, for sort of an obvious sort of dry run for his work with the Joker, while also obviously referencing the character in Inception. So fascinating film. The Prestige, again, fantastic. It's an ode to religion, materialism, capitalism, storytelling, filmmaking.
I would say it's my favourite novel.
It's the only one I haven't seen.
Second only to Following as his worst for me.
Oh my goodness.
I know, so Darren...
It's
written by Christopher Priest.
The novel was,
And the novel's good. Christopher Priest is a great science fiction writer, but... I remember reading an interview with him where he said basically the first time he got the script for The Prestige back, and it had the opening with Michael Caine explaining the three acts of a magic trick, and that's not in the book. That's a Nolan invention. And he was like, God damn it, they did it.
He strips out an entire subplot from the book that I think the film is a lot better for. He embraces a lot more of sort of the gothic 20th century storytelling tropes with nested narratives, this sort of like written through letters and diaries, new characters who are reading diaries in which characters are reading letters in which characters are telling stories. And they have this sort of wonderful nested structure, which is everything that Nolan's done in obviously Following, in Memento and stuff like that, but it's done, I think, in a wonderfully elegant way. It's probably my favourite Christopher Nolan film, and that's saying something given how fond I am of Christopher Nolan films. But let's get everybody back on side.
Where do you stand on Insomnia?
I think Insomnia is very good psychological thriller. I actually prefer it to the original.
Of course you do. I don't like
it.
The original's grand. The original's very well made. It's got a fantastic Stellan Skarsgård performance.
It does.
And it's got a wonderful directorial style.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I just find that the remake is cleaner, crisper,
You don't have to read those subtitles.
Unsurprisingly,
I don't particularly care for either of them. As films, like I quite like the original. I didn't particularly mind the Nolan one, but I never really cared for either.
Yeah, well, the original sort of goes into that almost parody of Scandi noir for me. It's got that sort of
Scandi noir didn't exist then. In fairness,
all right.
Yeah, like, I mean, you know, give it a
go.
He invented it in that regard.
I said I liked it.
That's did you though?
all right, let's win the crowd back.
All right, go on, do it then.
I watched Touch of Evil. The studio cut from 1958, because I'll be watching the direct or the assembly cut. The memo cut, basically, next weekend. So I wanted to see the theatrical again just to get a sense of it. And it holds together remarkably well. I know, obviously, Wells was very, very displeased at the point where he wrote a 58-page memo in which he outlined every editing change that he would make to the version of the film that he saw. It's amazing. And it holds up relatively well. The storytelling is sort of baroque and surreal and weird, but you're not watching for the storytelling. You're watching for the direction. You're watching for the camera moving through the spaces in this sort of liminal sort of border town. Well, the performances are fantastic, in particular Orson Welles, which is funny that you should mention that speech he gives in Compulsion, because Welles, like, and again, this is one of the things that gets lost in discussions of Welles as a filmmaker and as an actor. He was, in many ways, like an advocate for justice, in many ways, of course. His work on Touch of Evil, for example, was inspired by the Silent Lagoon case, in which a bunch of, I believe, Mexican-American immigrants were basically framed and set up. It led to the Zoot Suit riots in Los Angeles. But also even the blinding of Isaac Bradley after the Second World War by a police officer, where he was attacked. He was a veteran, a military veteran who'd come home from service, and was attacked by a police officer in an act of racially motivated violence. Welles wrote pamphlets and introductions and books on both of those cases, and they're very, very important to him. And you can see that in Touch of Evil, and the Touch of Evil is very much so amazing. It's kind of become one of those things where you look at his performance and you think of late Welles, even though he wasn't there yet. He famously wore padding in order to play the role.
But people almost assume that that's Welles. Like,
But it's astounding. I mean, you can almost forgive it for Charlton Heston as a Mexican. Yeah, you can almost forgive it for the scene in which a female character is placed in really creepy sexual peril, but then removed from that sexual peril and will never speak of it again, which is really awkward and cringy. And even at the standards of the time, which is the late 50s, it still feels very sort of crass. But it's an exploitation film.
Yeah.
And it's an exceptionally well made. The way the camera moves through and traces characters. I mean, the opening shot is the prime example of that. But even the scenes where Charlton Heston is chasing one of the guys through the sort of ruins of the city, the camera sort of zipping and zapping and sort of losing them and finding them again. It's absolutely beautiful, and it's very much ahead of its time. I mean, the argument is that he made a film 10 to 20 years too early for it to be understood.
It's almost New Hollywood-esque in a way. Like, it's that kind of sleazy.
Well, it has that sort of bridge.
That Chinatown almost kind of has that, you know.
It's that bridge between like Dublin, Downey, and China. It's got that sort of.
I think also it's worth mentioning that, like, and it should be kind of pointed out how close we are to actually seeing new Orson Welles film. Like, that's an incredible thing. Like, I mean, how good or bad or whatever.
Keep in mind that for 15 years we were similarly excited about seeing a particular Gilliam film, as we've talked about.
No, but this is being made. I know, I take your point. But this is a Welles film that's been kind of mythical for. Yeah.
And let's just say that I hope that all's well that ends other rewatch, Quentin Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs, just very, very briefly.
It's been a long time.
It's been a long time. It's a surprisingly lean Tarantino film. It's only 95 minutes long. It's very, very efficient. But watching it, I hadn't seen this in years, and it underscored to me how much Tarantino is a film director who spoke to sort of Los Angeles, people separated, stories overlapping, continuity sort of stuff, intersections of lives. But in Reservoir Dogs, you even have that sort of quality of memory and meaning, where you have characters who are holding conversations where you don't see the central act of the movie, the heist. You just hear about it in characters sort of like recollecting and discussing it. And not only that, but arguing with one another about what happened and in what sequence the events happened. And it's basically a story in that wonderful early 90s way about how everybody is fundamentally unknowable to everybody else. No matter what you think you know about a person, you don't know anything. And anything they tell you could be a lie, to the point where there's a great sequence where Tim Roth is telling a joke, and the joke becomes so real to him that it becomes a flashback in the context of the film, to the point where, like, this story that he made up and read from a sheet in a printout.
Oh, this is the police?
Yeah, this is the police. They're working undercover, It becomes, like, it becomes as real as any of the flashbacks that you've seen with any other characters. It's a
Roth
sounds
like hello, but as well, for remember.
Oh, yeah, Roth is fantastic. But that serves as a nice segue into the final film that I watched this week, where Roth is also fantastic. World Cup is happening. FIFA is back in the headlines. There has been absolutely no corruption with Russia. Vladimir Putin is fantastically happy that FIFA are keeping politics out of the ceremony, so I absolutely had to go back and watch the 2014 classic United Passions. Famous as the lowest grossing film at the US box office ever, two people attending its Los Angeles premiere, earning only $608 in its opening weekend, $988 in its total theatrical run. This is an astounding piece of work, released less than one weekend after the entire upper management of FIFA were escorted out of their hotels in handcuffs. This is a thing of beauty, and by beauty I mean horror.
So why have you watched it a second time?
These are the questions. I didn't rewatch it. I watched the first time.
Okay.
No, I'm never going back to this.
Okay, yeah.
Once is enough.
I was wondering what would bring someone back.
I sort of had that strong nostalgic feeling that took me back to June 2015. But it's astonishing. It's a biopic. It's a very earnest biopic. It cost me like $30 million with 80% of the budget coming from FIFA, which meant FIFA got final approval. Seth Blatter was apparently hanging around the set, making sure that nothing got off message on this film. And it's astounding. For its first half, it's the story about these poor, earnest, honest, hard-working Europeans who just want to bring football to the people using their own rules and regulations. And then, at the halfway point, it becomes the biopic of Seth Blatter, as played by Tim Roth, and it becomes transcendental. There's a moment where Seth Blatter is introduced with Sam Neill playing his predecessor, uttering the line, "Seth, I hear you're good at finding money." There's another moment, not within the same meeting, where Sam Neill's character says, "An organization such as ours cannot run on good wishes alone." Dramatic beat. "We need money." Dramatic beat. "We need a lot of money." And it continues throughout. There's this wonderful recurring motif of corruption that runs through the film without ever being articulated. There's a wonderful scene where Seth Blatter's best friend is the head of Adidas, the only person in the world that he can talk to. They hold a little meeting, they sit down together, they're having coffee, and Seth is like, "Well, this got very embarrassing. I just got a call saying that we couldn't pay our workers on Friday. I had to write a $200,000 check from my own personal account to make sure people got paid." And it's like, why did you have $200,000 just lying around in an account that you could write a check for? And then he's like, and the head of Adidas goes, do you know where the money's gone? And he's like, "Oh, I have an idea." And it's never mentioned again. There's a wonderful sequence where a journalist, a snappy Irish journalist, who's played by, like, he's played by one of the guys off Love Hate. He's got a skinhead sort of menacing vibe. There's a moment where Seth Blatter has a meeting with the journalist. He's like, "You said this was supposed to be a friendly off-the-record meeting," and storms off. But there's a moment where the journalist says, "Who are you protecting, and are they worth it?" And the film kind of implies that he's protecting himself, so he kind of is worth it. It's staggeringly tone-deaf. There's a moment where Gerard Depardieu, playing Rame, the guy who invented the World Cup, is sitting down reading an account of the infamous death match in the Ukraine and Germany. Completely fictionalized story in which a bunch of Ukrainian football players were rounded up by the Gestapo, forced to play football, and told that if they didn't lose, they would be shot. These triumphant men refused to play by the German rules, scored the goals, and defeated them 7-3. In retaliation, they were all murdered by the Germans. This scene of immense emotional importance is captured with Gerard Depardieu sitting in an office in Geneva, reading the newspaper as choir soars in the background, as an overlay of people in an ashen football field kick the ball back and forth, and Gerard Depardieu utters solemnly, "We weren't there." As if to say, if they had been, things would have been very different. It's a beautifully tone-deaf piece of work. It's an application of every biography stereotype that you could imagine. There's a literal corruption montage played to Wild Wild Life by David Byrne, which is just missing the sequence from Scarface where Al Pacino...
Was it the limit?
Yeah, that's it. It's where Al Pacino carries like big bags of money into a bank. There's a moment where like they're talking about like hosting the World Cup in Argentina, and Sam Neill is like, "Why is this a big deal?" And Seth says, "The sponsors are getting nervous," and the audience is about to go, "Oh no, not the sponsors." There's a moment later on where they're talking about, like, there's this recurring motif throughout about South Africa and apartheid and how even though football is above politics,
They
won't let South Africa play as long as apartheid's a thing. If you were to watch the movie, you would think that FIFA single-handedly ended apartheid, because it closes in 2004, I think it was, when they announced the 2010 FIFA World Cup would be held in South Africa.
Yeah.
And this wonderful self-aggrandizing congratulatory shot of Tim Roth CGI'd into footage with Nelson Mandela opening an envelope saying, I'm discovering this for the same time that you are. And there's this great motif running through where he's like, I will retire when we hold a World Cup in Asia and in Africa. That's when I know my job is done. As if the film is saying, not when I'm pushed out due to massive corruption charges. Yeah. I'm leaving on my own terms. It's staggering. Oh, yeah. It's like Diana. Remember
yeah,
Diana?
I do. This Darren, my son Darren watched Diana, which is one of the greatest
unintentional comedies
there's ever been.
It should have been on Empire's
list. And I've said it before, and I'll say it again, if you haven't seen it, please, please watch it.
Do
it is sensational.
Yes.
Yes. It is
sometimes
incredibly
the surgery.
Ill-judged.
And
funny.
Sometimes the surgery performs you.
Right. So Darren pitched United Passions in the same way, which obviously I was immediately attracted to the idea of it. I did mean to watch it last night. I didn't get to watch it last night. By next week's podcast, this will have appeared before my eyes, and I look forward to bringing that to the table next week.
Perfect.
Good Lord.
All right, then. So let's move on to talking about the week in film news. Big news this week is that the FilmFA, the Galway FilmFA, has announced 5 new titles that they're going to be screening. So they've announced Town of Strangers, Teresa O'Brien's film, Keith Walsh's When All Is Ruined Once Again, which are both having their world premieres, Donal O'Kelker's The Camino Voyage, and Neil McCann's The Science of Ghosts are also there. I believe The Science of Ghosts played at ADIF earlier this year.
Yes.
And Black 47, which is going to be the closing gala.
Which is good, because I missed that at ADIF. I was out of country, so I'm very much looking forward to catching it going.
It's good. So they're still in the process of finalising the lineup. They've announced basically all the films that are announced so far. So The Camino Voyage is one of the earliest films on Wednesday. The Science of Ghosts is airing after that. After that, it's Possum. Then on Saturday, there's The Town of Strangers. When All Is Ruined Once Again, Katie, the Katie Taylor documentary. On Sunday, it's Captain Morton the Spider Queen, and then the closing gala is Black 47.
Yeah, so I'm hoping to catch a few of those and a few more when the full list announced, which I imagine it's fairly soon.
It should be fairly soon. I mean, it's only a couple of weekends away. Mm. The Scandal podcast will actually be heading down to Galway for that
yes,
week
there,
to cover
there,
live.
There may be
a special
podcast of
on the road. Jay didn't get to go to Newport Beach Film Festival, but we're
I will go to the Newport Beach Film Festival.
They are
as a junket.
With a little because it's not worth. I like that.
I'm not going
because I love film.
No.
I'm going because I get one of those cool visitor badges.
Well, of course.
But yeah, so also the film class looking for volunteers. You can apply if you are interested. It's a great way to sort of get to know film
for young people. Too old for that.
Yeah. if you still have the sense of Spielbergian wonder that
which
seems
I do
to
not have
passed Jay by, you can catch up there. In terms of other news that's happening in the world of Irish film, because I'm not completely unprepared, the new releases in the IFI this month. So they're screening Mary Shelley is out on the 6th of July.
Okay.
The Racer and the Jailbird and First Reformed are opening on the 13th.
Ooh. I look forward very much to the First Reformed.
Yeah,
Racer and the Jailbird, myself and Darren seeing that.
It's amazing.
It's not a good film.
No, it's
but
not a good film.
It's really interesting in a way that
it's a bad film. It's an Ingmar Bergman Lifetime movie.
Oh, stop.
It features without a hint of irony the line, "I am not pregnant with new life, but with death." Come on, tell me. And Ronan is almost there. We've almost got Ronan.
It starts off as Heat, turns into a Bergman drama, and then ends as a Lifetime movie of the week. It's incredibly schizophrenic.
Yeah,
it's just weird.
Crazy.
It doesn't know what it wants to be. So I was like, oh, let's try this. It's really weird. It's really
Where's it from?
It's from
Belgium. French co-production or something. Matthew Schoenaerts.
Is the lead in it.
Yeah,
he's good. I like him.
Well, I mean give him the material
of,
that
he's been
he's
in a few stinkers, but he can work. Like he's very good in Bullhead and stuff like that.
Otherwise, yeah, so First Reformed, I saw it. I didn't like it as much as most.
Phil loved it.
Phil loved it, and everybody is raving about it as Schrader.
Ethan Hawke is being getting a lot of
Hawke is great.
He's fantastic.
Hawke does a lot of great work. Unheralded.
Well, he's arguably, I think the argument's made he's basically our generation's genre star, and that he's an actor who throws himself committedly into
literally in everything.
Absolutely everything that he does. You never get anything less than 100%, even in something like, what was it, Kill? Good Kill.
Yes.
Which is not a good film, but at the same time, Hulk is...
So I heard a few weeks ago you were talking about the Winchester movie, which is...
Yes!
So that's the Spearing Brothers, and you, no one knew who the Spirit Brothers were. But you guys got to see Daybreakers, which is...
is that Sam Neill and Ethan Hawke?
Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
I've seen that, actually.
It's really great. It's a
They're the guys who did Winchester.
Yeah, yeah.
And I want to see Winchester now.
And they did a movie that didn't work, didn't fully work, but it was really interesting, called Predestination a few years
ago.
Oh,
with the Hawk as well.
Where he's on the radio. Like, is there something like that?
Oh, he thought it was okay. Actually,
he's like a time cop.
Yeah. It's time cop, but with Ethan Hawke instead of Jean-Paul Van Damme.
Yeah.
How could you lose?
I've a lot of time for Ethan Hawke, and I'm a big Schrader fan.
I am all over Daybreakers, though. I'm looking at
Daybreakers is astounding. It's like a futuristic sort of like dystopian vampire movie where Sam Neill is Lord of the Vampires, and Ethan Hawke, is he a cop, vampire cop or something?
About crap, I need to see.
So basically, there's like it's been a while since I've seen Daybreakers, but basically, vampirism is the most prevalent thing on the planet, and they just need
blood, presumably.
Yeah,
ecologically, because
inhuman blood, but their food supply is running out. So
it's like somebody watched Blade and actually thought the evil plan through. It's like, we'll make everybody a vampire, but what are they going to drink?
So I haven't seen Winchester, but I have a lot of time for the Spirit Brothers as well.
Consider it
added to the list.
Added to the list. Very much so.
Perfect. In other news, the Dublin Feminist Film Festival has announced their dates and venues that will be taking place over the weekend of the 21st, 22nd of November in the Lighthouse Cinema. They're also running a short film program and a short film prize. So if you are interested in submitting, or if you have a short film, it'll be a great avenue to go through it. They're hoping to bring in sort of more filmmakers this time and sort of have a conversation about like the fantastic female filmmaking through like basically through looking at how representation works, obviously beyond the role of the director, even in other sort of off-screen roles as well. So it does look like it's going to be a fascinating year. In other film news, The Palace and The Lighthouse are staging a Brad Bird season next weekend, in which they'll be screening... Sadly, they won't be screening Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, but they will be screening The Incredibles...
Iron Giant,
and Ratatouille.
I will hopefully catch Iron Giant. I'm not that gone on Ratatouille.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of it either. But again, to be fair, Brad was drafted in at the last minute on that, I believe.
Yeah, sure. It's just the idea of rats in a kitchen. I could, aside from the UB40 song, I could never get past the idea of that. It's like, rats should not be handling food. And once that came into my head, it ruined the whole thing.
To be fair, they're only handling your man's head.
Yeah, but
using him as a puppet.
Tasting soup and stuff like that.
You don't quite see them, you know, defleeing themselves beforehand.
It's not the quiet, it's inferred. Off screen, there's a lot of soup diving going on, I suspect.
Soup diving. Thank you for that image today.
That's all right. Tip your waiter.
And very
good. It's as good as The Witches, as rats in the kitchen.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
The Witches is the Bette Midler one. Is this everything else?
Angelica Houston.
It's a Nick Rogue movie. And
it's
this is the Roald Dahl one.
Angelica Houston.
The boys turn into a rat.
So that movie like scarred me as a kid.
It's terrifying.
Like really, she takes off her mask and she has a long nose under like a human face. And like it just stayed with me forever. And then years later going, it was a Nick Rogue movie.
Yeah.
So, of course, he shouldn't be making kids movies.
Or, counterpoint, he should make it all kids movies.
Yeah.
I would love to see Don't Look Now as a child-friendly version. It's weird that you said it, because I kind of... And I wonder if there is... Like, if modern generations will have as, like, things that terrify them that are as simple as that. Like, the child catcher in Studio Dragbang, which is otherwise this bright, cheerful, like, PG-13 movie. But the child catcher is something that I think when people of a certain generation point to and go, everybody shudders. I wonder, like, can you point to that
I think this generation has the cartoon Adventure Time, which is genuinely unsettling.
This generation has a lot of cartoons like that.
Yeah, which is great. I think it's really great.
There's like Uncle Grandpa and...
Yeah.
What's it? Something... Dog, some weird dog cartoon that's just like a David Lynch show.
Oh, yeah, I can't remember the name.
Stupid Dog, it's really weird and kind of intense.
Yeah.
Really
Wait,
rabbits, wasn't it?
No, but David Lynch used to do a comic strip called The World's Angriest Dog.
Well, it's been, maybe it's kind of an offshoot of that, but it
my 7-year-old niece showed me, and I was like, it's dramatically intense. Like, you're watching this? I was like, I'm getting the
fear. I highly recommend Adventures High to everyone. It's fantastic, really.
All right. So before we go, let's run through the International Week of the Trailer, which happened last week, dropping of what seems to be a full feature-length movie worth of trailers last week by the major studios, including Lenny Abramson's The Little Stranger, if we're going with Irish films coming up, which looks... I seem to have liked this a great deal more than you, Jake.
It looks okay. It looks like
it's a genre
it's... film set in a house where something happened. You know, the English house where the ghostly thing happened that we've seen before in various films. It'll have to do a lot to stand out from a very kind of...
crowded field.
Yeah,
could doing a lot be being directed by Lenny
Abrams? Well, I hope so. It just says, like, trailers don't necessarily mean anything.
And they tend to be generic,
particularly horror films, which I suspect we'll talk about when we get to the new releases.
Yeah, and Lenny Abrams is a fine filmmaker. My worry is with those kind of stories, they tend to follow a certain
rhythm.
Plot and rhythm. And whilst they can be interesting and well shot and kind of based on really interesting material, they tend to be a little more generic for some reason. And so we can hope for better. I'm hopeful rather than... you know, I'm not
rather than fearful. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
although given the substance of the movie, fearful for the wrong reasons.
Maybe
like the Dumbo trailer. Tim
I
Burton's
didn't watch
Dumbo
because it's Tim Burton. So
I didn't watch it.
I'm done with Tim Burton. Okay.
All right. Then we won't run through the lightning round. Suspiria. Anybody? Any takers
on
Suspiria?
I'm looking forward to it, and so, because of that, I have no interest in watching the trailer because I'm already in.
I want to see it. I'm
quite into it. Except for the stunt thing, which is really...
Which stunt thing?
The acting thing.
Well, you're going to have to elaborate.
I'm trying to phrase it without saying exactly what it is. The stunt casting element to it.
Oh.
Oh, okay.
No? Really? No, Darren, you're Mr. Pop Culture. You're supposed to know this stuff. Tilda.
Swinton.
Yes.
Yes. As an instructor.
Yes.
In a Luca movie. I don't see why this is a surprise.
There is another actor in the film that may or may not be made up.
Oh. Who is Tilda Swinton?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
So it's the Snowpiercer effect, as I like to call it.
Okay.
Let's put makeup on Tilda.
I like how you were like, coy, because I'm not going to spoil it. No, but if you ask me questions.
You said you created an IMDb page for an actor that may or may not exist.
Oh, okay. Very similar to what Discovery did with their sort of...
And it was irritating then, it's irritating now.
Maybe Jay should stay off the internet.
What?
I feel like the internet is not good for you, Jay.
But if two people did good things, maybe it would be, Darren.
All right, then. Okay, fine. On that note, then, we'll move straight into the top 10.
Woohoo!
Jay's like, we skipped the other 16 trailers, including Donald Trump's Destiny Films trailer.
It's amazing.
They got the voiceover guy. They got the guy who does the voiceover for movie trailers to deliver lines like, "What if history could change?"
Yeah, I can't do it.
It would be funny if it was in any way funny. It's just scary.
Yeah.
It's just,
this is what the world is. This is the leading power, the most powerful nation on earth, and they have their basic National Security Council putting together movie trailers in which people ride speedboats and build condos on the North Korean.
And Sylvester Stallone, isn't it?
Yeah. But to be fair, a certain amount of it seems oddly calculated. Like, for example, when they're talking about things that the West can bring to North Korea, they pointedly include basketball shots because obviously he's a big basketball fan, being a fan of Dennis Rodman. Who would have thought that Dennis Rodman would be like the cultural nexus of 2018? But anyway,
I certainly would not think that.
All right, let's move on to talk about the top 10. At number 10, it's Kala, which is an Indian film about the life of Nelly, based on Tamils who live in large numbers in Mumbai.
Okay.
I have no frame of reference for this.
That's that one that was kind of City World Screens, that kind of...
It does. Well, I mean, to be fair, they generally do quite well.
They do top 10.
And I'm actually really, really... it's great to see, actually, to be fair.
Oh, yeah, it's terrific. And it serves an audience, period.
Yeah. At number 9, it's Life of the Party, which is the comedy starring Melissa McCarthy, written and directed with her husband, Ben Falcone. I haven't seen this yet. A studio, a questionable studio comedy that Darren hasn't seen.
Unusual.
Yeah. At number 8, still hanging in there and demonstrating that the Irish public actually absolutely love studio comedies, it's I Feel Pretty with Amy Schumer. That has done remarkably well. That's so far earned €834,000. Almost up to €1 million, which is remarkable in the Irish market with, you know, what amounts to a very small marketing campaign. And, you know,
it's done quite well.
And I mean, we don't really have, like, inside Amy Schumer didn't air over here properly, did it?
You would have had to go to, like, the Comedy Central to find it, which is remarkable. And again, it's astounding that she has the presence that she has here. I know she's a big force culturally over in the US, but to sort of to have made an impact. And I suspect this isn't going to be going anywhere, because I suspect that much like, we'll probably talk about this when we get the new releases, but there's a gap coming up as well in terms of the big blockbusters that are being released, which will maybe give a little room for smaller films to breathe. And I suspect I Feel Pretty will be one of those movies that will breathe. At number 7, it's Avengers Infinity War.
Ooh.
Yeah.
One of those smaller movies that will breathe.
I haven't got to this yet. I'm still planning on doing it in the way, probably the way I did Black Panther, which is like one of the last two screenings in Dublin.
You're not doing the 4D experience?
I think we missed it.
I don't know you.
You got my real name.
Don't go. You have agreed to do a 4D
experience. I have
experience.
Agreed to do it.
And Jurassic World is going to be in there for a while because there's no big blockbuster between now and then.
It's probably going to be Jurassic World to my...
Oh,
God,
that's amazing.
Damn it. This is what... You started, Ron. Don't check ahead. You were part of this.
I feel bad for you, but
thank you.
You know, I feel great for me that I'm going to get to enjoy this.
You
vicariously. But yeah, Avengers Infinity War. It's one of those movies that I am more impressed by the fact that it exists and functions than I am with it as a movie of itself. It's a remarkable accomplishment. If you were being very cynical, you could say it's a remarkable product in terms of just packaging organization.
I don't think you get to be cynical to say that. I think Marvel have a lot of stuff to move around and product is not... Like, I think they tried to do something okay, but the window they have, it's a narrow frame.
No, I mean,
I think they do it relatively well for what they do. I think they try to make okay films like that.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with an okay film in that context. Like, they're not making... dross in relative terms.
Yeah.
I'm really hoping this kind of signals a change of regime in Marvel where every movie doesn't have to be about the universe being completely destroyed. Like we can maybe we've got to this point and now we can do
is there any universe left?
Whatever is going to happen.
Whatever happens at the climax of this may push the idea of that to its logical extreme. In that, like, it's like, okay, all these characters have individually saved the universe, what can we do that will up the stakes in any way, shape or form? And then he's like, okay, done. And it's
spread it back out a bit then.
There's a point at which sort of that's the thing with the release of Ant-Man and Wasp later in the year.
Yeah,
much like the release of, I think the first Ant-Man came out after Age of Ultron.
Yeah,
the idea is that you decompress somewhat by doing a literally infinitely smaller
really
film.
I really liked Ant-Man.
I'd love to see Matt Fraction's run on Hawkeye translated to film. Like, there the stakes are literally a building
a bunch of gangsters in tracksuits. But again, and this is again the apparently there are rumors that they are planning a Hawkeye movie for 2020.
Yay!
I know. Jeremy
does
Renner,
does anyone want that?
No. Jeremy Renner's accountants may. But I would actually love to see a proper, like, a Netflix series with Jeremy Renner in the style in the style of Curb Your Enthusiasm. Come on, great
13 hours of Jeremy Renner is
13
too
hours
Jeremy
of
Renner.
Curb Your Enthusiasm, the guy with the bow and arrow. It's just like, you know. Like, where it's just constantly building to something that never happens.
Right, nobody
just
needs that much Renner.
I have no time for Jeremy Renner.
Neither am I.
All right then, tough crowd. Hopefully this will soften you up. At number 6, it's Sherlock Gnomes.
Has that gone up again?
Yeah. 646,000.
Sorry. Nobody knows anything. That's right.
That's the big takeaway.
I have one. I'm not even going to do it.
I admire the restraint. I do not have that.
Fine. At number 5, though, things are heating up a bit with Show Dogs.
I feel it's just the same top ten for the last 5 years.
Yeah,
every week I come back here, and every week it's goddamn Show Dogs and Sherlock.
It was Show Dogs last week, and the week before it was released.
It feels like it's been every year. I feel like 2016.
I mean, this has, to be fair, been like 7 weeks in dog years. I mean, if you think about it that way. At number four, Book Club.
Oh, yeah. I haven't been to see this yet.
You strike me as something you'll end up talking to him one afternoon.
Oh yeah, I'll absolutely warm to it. You know, it's Diane Keaton and Soul. That's all of my
favorite. Mary Steenburgen, Jane Fonda.
Some of my very favourite things.
Candice Bergman. Questionable food. 50 Shades of
Dodgy
Grey.
Dodgy posters. Yeah. Oh, it's got all the good stuff.
I mean, it has that look of sort of a really nice, pleasant film. And it's great because the reviews I've read in it have pretty much been split. Which is odd, because it looks like a movie that
you'd be like,
I enjoyed this. This was nice. This
it's not great, but it was fine.
But on the other hand, you have like the reviews that run the spectrum from this is amazing to this is the worst thing that ever happened. Which feels strange for a movie that
looks relatively benign.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the kind of thing that I would have already seen it if it was showing in, say, The Lighthouse, with the fact that I'd have to go to Cineworld or something. I'll be in Cork next weekend, so I may take my mother or something and try to dress
hint,
up
hint.
As being nice to her.
Ronan's sitting there with the popcorn saying, like, shut up, Mom.
I really, really hope your mother listens to the podcast.
Yeah. You're glad I didn't get the house.
Start at 26:40.
At number three, Solo: A Star Wars Story, which Dominic, I think you've seen.
Yeah, that was the other thing I saw on my adventures, and yeah, it's fine.
Yeah,
grand.
Jesus, between you and Darren, you're really selling the hell out of it. It's fine.
No, but
it does a job.
We've had this conversation online about Ron Howard is a perfectly capable filmmaker,
and there's nothing wrong with that.
Perfectly capable. If I'm ever called that about anything, you can just shoot me.
I'm now waiting for Jay.
Don't worry, we will never call you capable of anything. Don't worry.
Because I'm clearly not capable of anything.
I'm now imagining Jay's 2,000 euro Heaven's Gate in Dublin, and people going, that was perfectly adequate.
It was grand.
The issue, I guess, with the Solo movie is you're always dealing with the ghost of an unmade movie, and we mentioned Ant-Man earlier on, and that was another like perfectly fine superhero movie, but I really wanted to see Edgar Wright's version, and I really wanted to see Lord and Miller, what they did, and it would have been a different movie, and maybe it wouldn't have even worked. But
it might have made money.
It might have made money. But yeah, Solo's it's fun. Donald Glover's great.
Well, I mean, even the actors who are like doing what they do, like Woody Harrelson and Paul Bettany, are grand.
Yeah,
like I mean,
Phoebe Waller-Bridge from Fleabag is great as the
droid, which is fantastic. One of the things, and I feel like it's been out long enough that we can talk about this. One of the things I absolutely adore about Solo is that even though it's technically like the most like made for Star Wars fans movie you can imagine, that it has no surprises, no twists, it's got everything you expect in it, but it still finds a way to sort of needle those people who are like, oh, Luke's characterization's all wrong in Last Jedi. Well, it's like, thanks to Solo, you now know he's a slaveholder. It's like even in this most typical and generic of Star Wars films, you still have that sort of
why needle. If it's a typical and Star Wars fan service film, that Star Wars people not going to see it?
Because Star Wars fans hate what they love.
I hate Star Wars fans.
Well, I mean, there are lots of reasons to hate Star Wars fans, particularly
there are,
in the last couple of weeks.
Are. So yeah. They don't deserve movies, though.
No. Well, they don't deserve lots of things, Jay.
It's true.
But anyway, yeah, it's dropped down. It's already number three here. It may only earn something like 400 million worldwide.
Embarrassing about
it. Because it'd be reshot 80% of it. Imagine the budget's up about 200, 300 million.
This costs more than The Force Awakens because of the reshoots.
Okay.
The operating budget's around 250 million, which means that in order to turn a profit, it would have to make at least 500.
But they're guessing,
given the marketing that it would probably have to go over, it's not going to get anywhere near that, which is staggering. It means that at some point during the meeting, because you know that Disney, when they were planning this, had this conversation where they're like, look, if we release a Lord and Miller movie, it will only cost us like 125 million. We'll make, say, 400.
Maybe 500.
Without the bad buzz around the neck. But at some point, somebody in a meeting said, "No, we'll actually do the public flogging and spectacle of firing them, having people gossip
make
about
them." Make a
wrong
hurt on them, didn't
yeah. yeah. Well, no. Yeah, part of me wonders how the logic was, what the logic was in that meeting. Like, did Disney honestly expect this to do well? Or were they? Was it more about preserving the brand?
I think there was a bit of both. I think they thought of, this is the film post other films. I'm like, here's your Star Wars film.
Yeah.
Now give us all the money.
Yeah.
I guess the shame of it is, like, a Lord & Miller solo movie would expand our notions of what a Star Wars movie can be, and Ron and this one kind of just very much cements the idea of what a Star Wars movie
is. Like, there's a moment in there, like, there's one moment in there that I can point to as a Lord & Miller moment, and it's one of the best moments in the film. It's where it's revealed that Donald Glover's Lando has a walk-in wardrobe for his capes.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, I want a Star Wars movie that's more like that. That's what you're pitching it at.
There's a lot of people arguing that, like, a Lando movie would have made money.
It would have.
Yeah,
I think it would have.
And you probably could have done it cheaper as well.
Yeah, definitely could.
Interestingly enough, even though that opened after Deadpool 2, it's already dropped below Deadpool 2 on the top 10. It has a running total of under €1 million, whereas Deadpool 2 has already earned over €2 million. Deadpool 2 is at number 2 at the moment. So, I mean, like, even here, Solo's not doing especially well.
I think Deadpool 2 is kind of fun.
I like Deadpool 2.
I'm a sucker for, like, those B-list X-Men characters who get trotted out and stuff.
It's also, like, a very generic 80s action movie sort of thing going on, in that it's a very simple story. You point out, like, the fact that these superhero movies always have the stakes at the end of the world. This is pretty much your 80s, like, family. Being a family person is a superhero, which I imagine The Incredibles 2 will probably do a bit better later on in the summer, but as a palette.
I would hope.
But it's like, it's nice, it's small.
It's fine.
Which is good. And at number one, surprising absolutely no one, it's Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, earning almost €1 million, almost as much as it earned. It's actually earned more than Solo's total gross in its opening weekend.
People love dinosaurs.
People do love dinosaurs. I'm constantly amazed by this. The original Jurassic World astounded me because
it was
the second or third most successful movie of
all time? Yeah, so it's made over $2 billion, didn't it?
Yeah, which is astounding. And I mean, because
it's appalling.
Well,
which is a huge part. Like, I'm sorry, it's a dreadful film.
Well, I was talking about this with Luke, who was on the podcast last week, and he was pointing out, how many movie franchises can you point to that are making this level of dough on their sixth film, the fifth film, where only the first one has been decent, has passed the decent threshold. Like, you've had three failed attempts since that, you know, and people have generally accepted that they're not great, even though they've gone out to see them, and people are still flocking out to see.
I think people just want to see dinosaurs on a big screen, don't I mean,
yourself.
The simple pleasures.
I mean, for me, it's sharks. I mean, I'll be first in queue to see
the Meg.
Yeah.
Me too. Actually, I want to see the Meg.
Yeah,
that's my Jurassic Park.
I mean, years ago, you're a Schrader fan, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, years ago we were robbed of a Bret Easton Ellis and Paul Schrader shark movie.
What?
Yeah. It eventually, like, became
from American
Psycho. So we got the Canyons instead.
Yeah, we got the Canyons instead, so God
bless
us.
Which weirdly, I had a soft spot.
Really?
A small soft spot.
I have no spot for the Canyons.
Our kind of
Schrader
low key, not necessarily, but apologists? Low key Canyons fan.
James Dean was phenomenal in it as a man with no conscience.
Imagine
that. What are the odds?
How did we
pull that off? So let's move on to the new releases opening this weekend. McQueen, the documentary looking at Alexander McQueen.
Oh, it's obviously me.
Underwhelmed. No, it's not Widows, unfortunately, which was part of the trailer rush.
Which also looks great.
Did you watch the trailer for Widows?
I did watch the trailer for Widows.
Oh, didn't you mention that during the trailer section?
I was trying to get the trailer section over quickly.
Fine. Okay. So McQueen, the documentary directed by Ian Bonholt, looking at the life and times of Alexander McQueen.
There's a lot of documentaries in the last few years that have become a thing. It's like a little mini industry of fashion, photography, food, newspaper editor type documentaries. And they all seem to be the same documentary. And I know it's a sweeping generalization. I've seen a couple of them. I haven't watched the other 12 or 14 of them being released. But they all seem to be of a type and of a form. And Am I wrong in this?
No, I think I agree with you generally that there is a tendency to make these kind of profile of a significant figure that is in no way cinematic.
I think they fall into a trap, and I think music documentary did it for about a couple of years as well, where, you know, pick a music place like
Memphis, and then
do the same documentary
as
somewhere else, and I get very angry and antsy about documentaries and form and I like documentaries to be at least visually interesting, a little bit more innovative than I don't even mind talking about documentaries if you've got a story to tell. It's grand and it can be well placed information and all that kind of stuff. Do it well, punch it up and stuff. It's just telling the story because you like it is not enough in a documentary. Which McQueen would be good.
Also out this week, Studio 54.
Another
documentary about a particular place and time.
Well, I suppose at least Studio 54 has a kind of...
Well, it has any number of avenues it can explore.
But apparently, I read the Peter Rasher review of it, and it touches on a couple of things that people would have liked to kind of see more of. Like there's a huge thing, there's a huge kind of sidebar, apparently. And if you've read that about Studio 54, I think that Trump would have been a big... Person needs to go there a lot.
Yeah.
But apparently it's briefly mentioned documentary then just about the side. So things like that it feels like a kind of missed opportunity already.
Yeah.
You know, so somebody will have to make the definitive one 5 years for them. And then
you say the definitive one, you make it sound like there's a Ken Burns sort of 10-hour studio.
I mean there's a Mike Myers film
Are you actually going to stand up and defend?
I'm not. I have seen it, I've forgotten it completely, but
I think that may have been the good call.
Yeah.
Also at this weekend, Super Troopers 2.
I don't know what to say about it.
It never really, it's quite a big cult hit in America. But
yeah,
it never really took off over here, did it?
Yeah,
I think it's a peculiar American phenomenon in that it's about state troopers and as such sort of plays into a comedy that's very particular. Like, I imagine The Guard would probably be the closest thing we have, and that looks much darker, more cynical, and
It was good.
What were you saying, James?
James doesn't like
to get angry, but he does like to get catty. So Super Troopers 2 is opening this weekend, featuring Rob Lowe, in which the troopers head to Canada.
Okay. Featuring... Is that how it's... I'd like to see how it's... Is it and Rob Lowe?
It seems like an
featuring
and...
Introducing Rob Lowe.
Linda Carter's also in it as well, actually, so which is quite nice.
Wow, they're really going on.
Well, come on, tell me you're not more likely to see a movie now knowing it stars Rob Lowe and Linda Carter.
I'd be more inclined to see a movie starring Linda Carter than I would be with Rob Lowe. But anyway...
That comedy he did was apparently very good. The one that he did with... what's it called? The Closer? Not The Closer. But it's the one in which
I've watched a bit of it.
I've heard it's phenomenal.
Rob Lowe.
He plays an actor who played a lawyer on television for 7 seasons.
Oh, I do remember.
Back with his family basically decides to become a lawyer. Apparently, it's
kind of a cancel dinner.
There's apparently an episode where Timothy Oliphant, who played the lead on his rival show in Los Angeles, comes to town, and they proceed to actually have a legal argument together. It's apparently something.
Actually, going to just mention just because you said it, and my favorite joke this week, Timothy Oliphant. In Rachel Kimothy Smith, Tyler says, "Sorry, Kimothy Oliphant, you call it Lee Cotter," and that is slayed me. I was
consistently that show makes me shriek.
I couldn't breathe.
I hear the new season's kind of back on.
I really like it.
On season two.
Yeah. All right.
Oh wow!
I hoovered up. It's a half season. The new season.
Yeah.
So I hoovered up.
And apparently it's much more formally experimental and stuff like that.
And it's always been a bit weird, but it's kind of weirder, yeah.
Well, I mean, there's a half-hour Netflix documentary in the middle of this one, apparently, is what I'm hearing.
Did you play with Netflix, the whole Netflix thing as well? It's good.
It's apparently...
I mean, Kimothy Oliphant is amazing. Sorry.
That is wild. It has a wild sense of humor.
It is.
It's strange.
It's great.
Well, which is the great thing about being on Netflix. You can
but
do
I
that
already did something today.
All right, and the big release this week, which is the weekend that the World Cup is launched. launching, and so we're going to enter a sort of a more experimental and perhaps sort of broader summer season.
I'm afraid.
Hereditary is the big release this
year. Yes, yes.
Which is great. It's great to see like a horror film that did very well in the festival circuit.
But is it a horror film?
Stroke that chin.
Now, listeners can't see, but if you listen very closely, you can hear the sound of Donegan's chin. But yeah.
People who say that genuinely should be taken out the back and buried somewhere. That's
It allows broadsheets to talk about horror. That's what
possibly reconcile themselves to liking a genre film. It's like, shut up.
Well, these are the people who argue that Touch of Evil isn't an exploitation film, for example. They're the people like, oh, it's a work of serious art. It can be both. But yeah, and Hereditary is the movie from Ari Aster. It did very well in the festival circuit. Did very well with critics. Even our critics over here are absolutely loving it. Did very well at the box office in the US, where it earned its budget back in its opening weekend. Did less well with audiences. I should be honest here, I've not seen this yet. I'm looking forward to catching it before the next podcast. But one of the interesting...
I'm really excited to see it.
One of the interesting things about it is that it's brought out that divide that exists with... And I think this is what Dario was getting at when you're saying, like, is this really horror? The divide that exists between prestige horror and the expectations that audiences have for a horror film, as demonstrated by, say, the cinema score, where this is a movie that scored, like, across-the-board rave. So it got a D+ from audiences who actually went to see it. And this is in a long chain. Like, It Comes at Night is another one that got a very strong audience rejection.
Yeah, It Comes at Night is not a horror, really.
Okay.
But again, I don't think it's intentionally
a horror.
The
podcast has become self-aware, people.
No, I actually didn't think it was an end-of-the-world drama. Like, and it quite clearly set that out, I thought.
Okay. But
I think it might have been Miss...
The Witch or The Vitch.
Which is a horror.
Yeah, that also got a C- score as well. So there's a history of
Think about it.
Whereas in contrast, something like Happy Death Day, which, to be clear, I absolutely love Happy Death Day. Happy Death Day is great fun. Not as good as The Vitch or as It Only Comes at Night. Is it The Witch or The Vitch?
It's The Witch.
It's a weird type of graphical thing.
Okay, cool. I do like Vitch though, because it makes me sound like Boris Badenoff. But yeah, so the Witch, which, you know, is a much The Witch Witch is a much better horror movie. But is a much better horror movie than Happy Death Day, whereas Happy Death Day can get an A cinema score.
But it's fun, though. Is that what the thing is?
Well, this is the argument, is that A, and this is kind of what you're getting at with the trailer stuff that you were talking about earlier with regards to The Little Stranger, right? Which is that studios, when they're selling horror movies, know what audiences want from horror movies, and so cut them so they look like conventional horror movies. Like, the trailer for Hereditary looks like a traditional jump scare horror movie. The trailer for The Little Stranger looks like every other horror movie set.
Because they're selling it.
Because that sells it. And the idea is that when people actually get to the cinema and see it, and it's either A, not what they expected, or B, it is what they expected. Scott Mendelson, who writes at Forbes, and is actually like one of the most on-point people when it comes to discussing how audiences relate to films, his argument is that there's also the fact that the movies that tend to get low cinema scores, and this may be very cynical, but I think there's some truth in it, are the ones that have downer endings. He noticed that, like, movies that tend to have downer endings as opposed to happy endings will get lower cinema scores, because obviously when you come out, your immediate response is, what the hell has this movie done to me? You're not going to give it
but
a name.
Surely, cinema scores is not really any barometer.
Well, cinema scores is not any
barometer. No, I know, but I mean, the idea of collecting them as a concept is
It's a marketing gimmick. It allows you to sell it as an A. It's basically, it's self-selecting. It's people who have paid for a movie on its opening weekend in one particular location, selected at random, and asked after the movie's over what they thought about it. It's a completely arbitrary and senseless score. It is interesting for getting a random sampling, but it's not like a, you know, you wouldn't put that, or you shouldn't put that on the DVD, but then you shouldn't put the Rotten Tomatoes score on the DVD, and people do that anyway.
I've got a theory on the horror, though, in terms of how people view it. I think it all changed a little bit when Scream came out, in terms of once you start, and I'm not saying Scream was the first film to have a kind of postmodern sense of horror film, but I think in terms of box office and in terms of cinematic expectation of horror and how it can be entertainment, quote unquote.
No.
I'm not suggesting that Scream invented this, but what I'm saying is, following that and how horror films are pitched and the fact that they can be big box offices kind of thing. And but I know, go on.
That's why basically horror movies have become like a, you know, make a very quick return on a very low budget.
No, I know,
because they always attract audiences. Yeah.
No, I know that. But I'm saying that in terms of cinema scores is what I'm getting at. In terms of how people view the horror experience is what I'm talking about.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't think that there's a difference. I don't think you discount... I think Scream is one of the best horror movies ever made, even if it's not particularly scary. I think Halloween is one of the best horror movies ever made. I think that even Nightmare on Elm Street, even though they're much more visceral, tangible, jump-scary movies, I think they're fantastic
movies. Yeah, I enjoy all of those you mentioned. Yeah. Not a real argument. But I'm saying... I guess I said, how audiences interact with film and how... And I think, and I mentioned Scream because Scream has a, and I remember, because I saw Scream when it came out, and I'd seen previous horrors in the cinema before Scream, but what I found really interesting when I saw Scream is that audiences had a playful participation in a horror in a way possibly that they didn't have
before
that. And I think the films that followed that, including sequels and the referential kind of nature of that, and the way horror films like
Scream
Cabin in the Woods.
In the cinema again.
I think things like Cabin in the Woods and everything, which exist to some degree because of Scream.
Yeah.
And there's a variation on that.
I mean, Get Out, for example.
Yeah, audiences are aware of
this is horror history
in a way post-Scream that they possibly wouldn't have been aware of beforehand because it was more underground to some degree. I don't think that's unique to horror.
I think that's just pop culture in general. It's not increasingly referential.
I'm not saying it's unique to horror. What I'm saying is, in the context of how people interact with horror in that regard, in terms of people coming out of a film and saying, no, that wasn't for me, because it doesn't necessarily fit a certain kind of way they have seen horror in the last 15, 20 years maybe.
I'm more willing to give people benefit of the doubt.
Oh, I never do. Okay. So, but I take your point, though. And I think the downer-ended thing that was Scott Ellison, I think that's a fair point also, and I think that will contribute hugely to it, I would imagine.
All right. But anyway, we'll probably be back next week when hopefully some of us may have actually seen the film we're talking about.
But I'm hoping to see it, but I have the World Cup as well, so you know.
Yeah, distributors.
Things exist outside films, people.
But that is why they...
No, don't say it.
Yeah. You can also watch United Passions.
Indeed.
Anyway, so this year's, if they want a bit more Jay Ronan or Donnick in their lives, where can they find you guys?
Oh, good Lord. At Jay Kyle on Twitter.
At Baron Ronan on Twitter also.
At Film Grabber on Twitter, and you can check out the Film Grab website as well if you want... thousands of images from films.
If you want content.
Content!
In inverted commas.
He's a brand, people.
I talked a little bit about United Passions earlier. This weekend, on my other podcast, 250, I'll be discussing that in a bit more depth with a panel of four powerful pundits.
Hang on, what? You're doing that on the 250?
It's on the bottom 100. It's the 55th worst movie ever made.
You are a marveler.
It is astounding. Anyway, so take it easy, guys. We'll be back next week. Bye.
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 I never forget the first moment when I walked into a cinema. I was hooked from there on.